Good evening. Welcome to the latest edition of The Definite Article, where we discuss a recent article or publication by an IEA author. I'm Sai Kamal, the IEA's Academic and Research Director. I'm also a Professor of Politics and International Relations at St Mary's University in Twickenham. This week, we'll be discussing an article by our Head of Lifestyle Economics, Chris Snowden, that was in fact the Spectator's cover article. The title is The Lost Boys, The White Working Class is Being Left Behind. And to discuss Chris's article, we're clearly joined by my colleague Chris Snowden, but also Ben Bradley, Conservative MP for Mansfield and Woolsock, who has tried to raise this issue in the House of Commons. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Let me start off by setting the scene here, if you like. You know, I come from a working class immigrant family. My dad told me about the prejudice that he faced when he came to Britain and in the early years. And as a kid, I was always told, you've got to work twice as hard as the white kids in this country. And then over the years, the debate has always been about underachieving sections of different minorities, black kids, brown kids, et cetera, they're underachieving compared to their white compatriots. But Chris, what you point out in your article is that while white working class males are the largest disadvantaged minority, their cause is the least fashionable. And we're not speaking about how white working class males are falling behind when it comes to educational achievement. Why do you think that is, and what do you think needs to be done to change it?
Well, that's a very big question. I'm not really sure what needs to be done, but I think we can get a few pointers from the statistics. The article really looks at, first and foremost, educational attainment. And across the board, whether it's GCSEs, A-levels, or university admissions, with the sole exception of Gypsy Roma, the white working class, if you want to call them that, white boys on free school meals in particular, are doing worse than every other ethnic group, whether it's Bangladeshis, Black Africans, Black Caribbeans, be what it may. And there are significant differences within the BAME category as well. So Chinese girls doing much better than Caribbean boys, for example. But white Brits are doing worse, and the gap is widening. The figures themselves are quite striking. The most remarkable figure, I think, is that 48% of kids in inner London on free school meals are going to university. That is nearly twice the level outside London. It's four times the level for white British boys. And I'm not one for targets and quotas, and I discuss the various targets from the BBC and people elsewhere in the article. I think it's more a case of learning what's gone right for those groups rather than playing the violin necessarily for particular groups elsewhere. And I'm not an educationalist, but there have clearly been reforms made in some schools. You've seen the success of the Michaela School in London, which has a very large black population in its classes. And I think we should be trying to learn, and let's find out what's going on. Yeah, maybe, as I say in the article, maybe there's nothing the government can do about certain aspects of this. When I asked a teacher down the pub why he thought that white boys were falling behind, he just said, well, immigrant families are stricter and girls are better behaved. And so maybe there's not much we can do about cultural things like that. On the other hand, girls have probably been always better behaved, but they haven't been marching ahead of the boys. Until relatively recently. Now you've got 57% of the people going to university are females. There's a lot more women at university than there are men, and that gap does seem to be widening. So I don't think it's a case of equating the underperformance of white kids or white boys in school with racial discrimination in the 1970s. The two are incomparable. But the figures don't bear out the popular narrative. I think there's room for improvement and room for learning from these ethnic groups that are doing better.
Chris, it's interesting. When I was asked to chair this discussion this evening, my instinctive reaction was, I think it is a subject that's worth discussing, but how do we discuss this in a sensitive way without being accused of downplaying racial or gender barriers? How do we discuss this without being seen to dismiss discrimination faced by people, black people, brown people, women, for example. How do you think we do that, Chris?
Well, hopefully it's not too much of an issue. There's been a few people since the article came out have congratulating me for being brave. But to be honest, there hasn't been anybody knocking me for saying what I'm saying. So I'm not sure it's quite as controversial as people maybe assume. I mean, they're just different issues, you know? I mean, it should be possible to accept that there's a problem with, for example, the police stop and searching a disproportionate number of black youths, while also accepting that there might be a problem in our schools with low-income white British boys as well. I mean, you can handle more than one problem at the same time, I would hope.
So let me turn to you, Bren. I know you've tried to raise this issue in the House of Commons. You faced a bit of a problem with the Tabling Office. Do you want to tell us about your experience and then talk us through the subject in a wider context?
Yeah, it's been a challenge to raise it here. And you know, you pointed in the beginning about it not necessarily being a fashionable topic to talk about. There's a sense to focus on ethnic minorities or on girls when it comes to equality. So I think part of the challenge here is that misinterpretation of the Equalities Act and what it means. That meant that the Table Office here in the Commons, when I tried to submit a question about working class white boys to the Equalities Office for questions, said it wasn't relevant. They said they didn't think the department would take it because it wasn't talking about protected characteristics. Now, of course, to me, protected characteristics are sex and race rather than, you know, girls and BME, which is often how it seems to be interpreted. So I am actually asking it on Wednesday. I've managed to persuade them and get myself in there. So hopefully we can get some decent answers from government. But I think Chris is broadly right. You know, it's not rocket science. It's a case of learning from other areas where things have gone really well. I personally don't like the identity politics, but you end up kind of forced to raise it in terms of white working class boys as opposed to just disadvantaged kids, because otherwise it seems like this particular group gets forgotten and the emphasis always shifts to how do we support, you know, particular groups, and that group is never poor white lads. So it certainly seemed necessary, but I hope we can move beyond that and learn from some of the lessons that have existed elsewhere. You look at things like the London Challenge, Chris mentioned London and the difference that the outcomes, different outcomes in the city of London. The finance, the emphasis on social mobility that happened within the London Challenge means actually there's very little difference on average between free school meals kids and everybody else, which is not replicated across the rest of the country. So it is doable, but it takes a bit of a change of emphasis, collaboration and financial support to make it happen.
And how do you think we raise this issue without being accused of downplaying the disadvantages faced by kids and others from ethnic minorities?
I think we need to look at it in terms of how do you support the most disadvantaged rather than, I mean, to me, you know, race has got nothing to do with it when it comes to educational attainment or, you know, the standard of education or whatever may exist in different communities. Obviously there are cultural differences and regional differences in terms of the stats, but actually the support that's needed and the support that everybody gets should be equal if we want everybody to have equal opportunity to get on. The challenge tends to be that a lot of these communities are overall, you know, socioeconomically quite deprived, you know, have more kids in care, have more of those kind of challenges. You come to Mansfield, I've got primary schools where 70% of kids are involved with social services. It's dealing with those challenges in terms of the levels of disadvantage rather than anything to do with skin colour or even gender. I do think when it comes to boys in communities like mine, there is almost a bit of a narrative, though, around kind of working with your hands and the history and the industry. A lot of, you know, lads' dads didn't go to university. They worked down the pit or they worked in the factory. And there's still a kind of drive towards that. Parents' experiences, you know, they didn't go to university themselves. So they don't necessarily push their kids to go and do that. And it's not always the right thing. So we do need to look at that kind of stuff and what kind of education, what kind of support is right for different places. But broadly, I think the answer is just stop talking about in terms of skin colour or characteristics and start talking about the actual kind of the issue itself.
So Chris, let me come back to you. Do you think there's a problem that when you look at diversity programmes and targets that they are focused on visible diversity, you know, diversity of gender and race, but they ignore those who have other disadvantages, and that's where you miss out on the disadvantaged white kids, if you like. You know, as you know, as you note in your article, you say, in Britain, class has always been the most significant indicator of true privilege. So is there still a class issue in this country, and do we tend to forget that in the face of racial disparities?
Yeah, I think it's being swept under the carpet. It's almost a cliche now, amongst some people to say that there's a lack of diversity of thought at, say, the BBC or in universities. But there is also lack of diversity of class. I have a real problem with, we can't call them quotas because quotas are technically illegal, but targets which have exactly the same effect, particularly when the target requires a greater proportion of whichever group than you find in the actual population. The BBC is a very good example of this. So BBC has a range of targets. It had a target not that long, only a few years ago, it's easily been met, which is having 8% of its workforce and management be LGBT, but only 2% of the population is LGBT. It might be slightly higher in a workforce, but clearly requires more LGBT people than you would get if you just assume that talent is evenly dispersed across the population, which I think you have to do. It has a target of 50% women, which on the face of it seems reasonable until you consider that only 40% of the full-time labour force are women. And it had a target for BME of 15%, which is larger than the proportion in both the population and the labour force. And after the Black Lives Matter protest, it increased that to 20%. Now, in practice, although none of these organizations would ever admit to any kind of discrimination in interviews, in practice, if you're going to meet those targets, you will have to discriminate against people who don't have those characteristics. It would be like setting a target of 95% of the workforce have to be white British. Well, only 87% of the population are white British. So it would require some kind of subtle or not so subtle discrimination along the way. That I object to, because that seems to me to require racial discrimination or discrimination on the basis of gender or sexuality. And I kind of allude to this towards the end of the article, that maybe this kind of thing, this kind of so-called positive discrimination, if it's happening all along the chain, as it were, you know, it's certainly happening in corporations. To some extent, perhaps it's happening in the education system. You know, Oxford University recently said that it was making steady progress on making its campuses representative of wider society, because 20% of its British students are BME. I could never say that. I think I'd just say BME. BME. Well, again, that's a much larger proportion than you have in British society. That's not steady progress. You've far exceeded the target, in actual fact. And I do wonder whether this has created some kind of climate in which people who don't like any of these characteristics start to feel surplus to requirements.
And let me ask you the same question. Do you think, you know, the targets are focused mostly on visible diversity? And I asked a question about class, which Chris raised in his article. We've got a question on YouTube, that very much along the lines, is class still the defining feature in educational attainment, white and working class? I was the first in the family to attend university. Middle-class opportunities were better. Middle-class kids were better primed by their graduate parents. So is that the issue that we're facing here? What do you think, Ben?
I think it's certainly one of them. I touched on before, you know, you've got whole swathes of communities where a tiny proportion of parents have gone to university. You go back through all the industries that sustain Mansfield and they just didn't. And you left school at 16 and you went to work in whatever industry was available. And even now, you're talking, you know, 11, 12% of young people head off to university compared to half of young people nationally. So there is, you know, there isn't the same drive and support there. And there's also, you know, less of an understanding perhaps of things like tuition fees and all the rest of it. Just this impression of, you know, kids being saddled with debt, and that's a bad thing, as opposed to an aspiration to go to university and, you know, to try and get through that. There's also the problem of increasingly these days, and, you know, hopefully it's not too controversial of you, but more and more of those young people who do make it to university and who are the first person in their family to go to university actually don't get the outcomes from university that their parents' generation would have got. So that the social mobility element of that is reduced. You know, it's not, university is not an end in itself. It's where you get to as a result. And if actually it doesn't help you into graduate work, you know, it's not the same lever or, you know, ladder up the social mobility kind of gains as it used to be. So there are definitely those challenges. And in terms of the working class question, you know, obviously, even places like Mansfield, which is one of the most disadvantaged parts of the country, has people moving in from all over the place. It's ever changing, and the demographic is ever changing. But there's still very much a feeling and perception of being a working class town, of people being, you know, working class people with a certain way of viewing the world and a certain, wish list for life. I've often said in this space that we're often guilty of, you know, pressing very middle class ambitions onto to people and onto communities who don't necessarily want them. I think sometimes we measure these things in the wrong way. But I hope, as we go forward, I mean, some of the shift in narrative, my particular interest is education. So some of the shift in narrative recently around promoting technical education, around promoting college and FE and apprenticeships over university, I think is really, really positive and can be part of helping to shift the narrative on all of that.
Well, while I've got you, Ben, let me ask another question, which is coming from Tasneem Rahman, who says, do you think that the north-south divide plays a big part in the group being left behind? She also goes on to ask a variation was, you know, if we're going to have diversity targets, should they be based on income first and foremost? But do you think, why don't we tackle this issue about the north-south divide?
I used to think that. I used to think, is it north-south? But the more I think about it, the more I think it's cities and towns. There are very deprived and disadvantaged parts of the southeast, even though overall it's quite affluent. They tend to be towns outside of those major conurbations where there are fewer jobs, where there is lower educational attainment, and that economic, it's not a proven rule, right? But that economic imbalance seems to be much more tightly bound around that divide between major cities, metropolitan centres where the work is located, and often where there's more money for things like schools and all that kind of stuff, as opposed to towns which are increasingly just, the residential area that provides commuters into the city, right? So that's the divide as far as I can see. There are some very affluent parts of the north. You know, Manchester's probably more like London than it is like Mansfield these days. So that, I guess that's the answer to that one. Remind me of the second one.
The second part of it was about diversity targets. Should they be based on income first and foremost?
I think it certainly needs to be discussed. You mentioned, and Chris has touched on the BBC as an example of where there is great diversity in terms of skin colour and sexuality and all the rest of it, but not, as the cliche goes, diversity of thought. You could say the same about government. You know, it's all well and good having more BME people in government, but actually if they all went to Oxbridge, it's not necessarily diversity in the way that is beneficial. So it definitely needs to be considered in different viewpoints, different socioeconomic background. I do think that, you know, people's views on life are probably more shaped by their class, if you want to use that word, but by that socioeconomic background than just on race alone. I got slated on Twitter a few months ago for saying that a young black lad from a private school in Hampshire has a better chance in life than a free school meals white kid from Mansfield, and statistically that's true, but we don't tend to look at it that way.
Yeah, and it goes back to the point that we were making earlier. It's very difficult to talk about these issues without being accused of downplaying the lack of opportunities for others. Chris, let me ask you about the north-south divide. Do you think that plays a role here?
I think it plays a role in the same way that the class does. It's something that used to be taken more seriously, perhaps, by people on the left than it is now. I think there's been a conscious decision to sideline class, particularly kind of in the labour movement, on the left wing of politics. And the left wing intelligentsia has always been upper middle class, let alone middle class. It has, until pretty recently, and I guess still does to a large extent, claimed to speak for the working class. But that claim has become less and less tenable as time has gone on, and things like the Brexit vote and indeed the last election have increased the distance between the working class and the people who supposedly represent them. And so over time, probably starting from when Margaret Thatcher got a lot of working class votes, these people have moved on to try and represent other disadvantaged groups. But the thing is, you know, they're not, ethnic minorities are not disadvantaged per se. And it's easier, I guess, for a corporation or indeed a university to get in an African prince or a high caste Indian than it is a lad from Mansfield, you know?
Yeah.
And people on low incomes are disadvantaged by definition. Being a certain skin color, you're not disadvantaged by definition. Now, maybe, you know, people believe in intersectionality and all that will say that that's just, you know, fundamentally wrong, but I just don't accept that view of the world. So, yeah, I think have consciously sidelined the working class, and I include a lot of Northerners, obviously, in that. And the diversity that is often promoted and advertised can very easily be just a group of people who look slightly different, maybe have different sexualities, but are actually all pretty well-to-do people, perhaps from London or the south of England. It's a rather superficial diversity.
Yeah, it's it reminds me of a couple of comments I remember here. I remember I had a friend at university, a black friend at university, who said he loved diversity targets because it helped ambitious black middle-class professionals like him. And I also remember another few debates around it. But one of the questions I want to ask really is another question coming from Gallant Co., who says, why might it be specifically boys in that socioeconomic or racial group and not girls as well? You know, Chris, your article focuses very much on white boys not doing it as well, that well. What about the girls? What is it about the boys versus the girls, if you like?
It's a very interesting question. But I mean, again, I don't really know, but the statistics cannot really be gainsaid. It has not always been the way, I think I said before, that the girls outperform boys at schools. I think I remember the point at which girls overtook boys in GCSEs and A-levels. I can't remember when abouts that was, but it was definitely in my lifetime. And since then, that gap has increased and increased. So it's not just the case that girls are better behaved in school, clearly. I'm not sure what it is. There has been a huge feminization of education over the years. 70% of secondary school teachers are female, 82% of primary school teachers are female, and you get to early years, it's getting on for 100%. That, I think, has to have some kind of effect. I mean, the curriculum has been changed over the years in order, to some extent, to help girls get better grades, and maybe there's been an overcorrection there. I'm really not sure. There might be something else to it.
Do you have a view on that? Why boys are underperforming compared to girls in the same?
Yeah, system? I mean, so disadvantaged white girls are the second lowest in terms of attainment out of anybody. There is a very much a socioeconomic element, a working class thing, but boys lag far behind the girls. And I think within that particular group, there's a real kind of it's a cultural divide, in my view. Chris mentioned the feminization of schools, but I think there's increasingly on the national narrative, this almost negativity about masculinity. Increasingly young white lads from places like mine, you know, not quite sure what their role is in life, all the stuff that their parents taught them about, you know, chivalry and holding the door open for a lady and stuff now gets you in trouble. Don't quite know, you know, the drive in education is towards university. If you've not reached university, you've basically failed. So what's the point from that perspective, and how do you engage these young lads in school? I think increasingly, if you know, dad's an electrician, he's done pretty well for himself, I want to be an electrician, I can go work for my dad, why do I need to bother with GCSE history, you know? And I think that is a huge challenge to overcome, and my answer that I keep trying to push in Parliament is just a different kind of education, more technical vocational style education from an earlier age. And I think you see examples. I met a young lady in my constituency, this was a girl rather than a boy, but prime example of where actually failing at school, about to drop out, was allowed to go on day release to college and do a vocational course and flew. Now she runs a beauty salon and she employs people because she found that different thing, that kind of education and reason to engage with learning. For a lot of young lads, it's sport, or you know, the obvious example is like boxing interventions in really deprived communities. But it's finding that thing that engages lads with school and with wanting to learn. Because I mean, I certainly found as a kid sat in biology class thinking, what on earth is the point in all of this? Why should I bother? And when you haven't got parents necessarily driving you to attain and to succeed at school, you're just kind of left adrift.
I wonder if I can ask you, is there a cultural issue here? I know you touched upon it, Ben. You know, when I was growing up, I remember a lot of my mates saying, oh, we're working class, society's against us, doesn't matter how hard we work, we can't achieve, I'm not going to bother. My dad would say, no, you know, you've got to bother, and push me. And Vinesh Kamath has asked the question, do you think that this is an unfortunate self-fulfilling prophecy in that many white working class boys don't work as hard due to a belief that they are confined to a future of low social mobility? Is there that sort of barriers holding themselves back, or cultural barriers?
I think there are cultural barriers, and we've touched on some of them. I think there is an element of that. You know, the more and more you see that, you know, all of your mates who you were at school with are still living in the same house, in the same community, doing the same job 20 years later, because there is nowhere else to go from your perception. It's almost like, what's the point? I know I'm going to go and work for my dad's business, so that is what it is, and why aspire to anything more? I think there is that challenge, and particularly, as I say, with parents who've not gone to university, high levels of families where, you know, kids are in care or have got social care interventions, you've not necessarily got the drive that it sounds like you had, Syed, to say, no, you've got to try, you've got to do more. So there is definitely a cultural element. I think some of it comes from the wider, you know, societal kind of cultural battle that we've seen about who gets listened to over some of this stuff. You can see it in Black Lives Matter, you can see it in Brexit and all the other symptoms of it. Is, you know, it's almost kind of a working class versus middle class, leave versus remain type conversation. Nobody ever listens to us, so what's the point? But I think those battles have been more vocal recently, haven't they, since the referendum, and people realise maybe it is worth having a go.
What about you, Chris? Do you think there's a cultural element here of you know, communities talking about barriers and not bothering to work as hard? Or do you think that's simplifying the issue?
Well, I do think that for a lot of particularly first and second generation immigrants, there is a massive drive to work hard. And obviously there are exceptions to that, as in anything, but it's not wholly surprising to me that you get kind of tiger mums and stuff, you know? So, I mean, again, I go back to this thing of, you know, let's not be too downhearted about this. You know, let's learn from the people who are doing the best. If we can get the whole, you know, white British up to the standard of Chinese girls, it would be an unbelievable boost to productivity. So let's you know, try and learn the lessons there. So I don't really know what culture means a lot of the time in these things. It's such a broad term. But I it's a simple word, isn't it, to cover an extremely broad and complex range of different issues, and the issues will be different around the country depending on different people. And I, as I said to start with, I don't think the government can solve all of this, but it would be nice if we at least acknowledge the gap and try and learn where we can.
You say governments can't solve it. Do you think the markets can solve it? You know, is there a market solution here, Chris?
Well, I think the free schools, if you count free schools as a market solution, I'm pretty sure the Michaela School is a free school. They seem to produce pretty good outcomes, as people like us side would expect. If you give people more choice, if you allow people who run schools and teachers to do things differently, then, yeah, you expect better results. So that, I think, is a very good innovation. Behind all this, of course, is always the question of grammar schools, which I've kind of divided views on. I went to one myself, went to a state grammar. And I think over time I've come to the conclusion that they're a good thing. I know there's mixed research on this, but I think, to be honest, a lot of the research is kind of junk because it's so distorted by the fact that there are so few grammar schools. So you'll hear people saying that there's very few people on free school meals go to grammar school. Well, that is true, but there's only 160 odd grammar schools, and they are, you know, they've led to a massive increase in house prices around them. You know, the grammar school I went to in Ripon has some of the highest house prices in the north of England, purely because of the school. If there were 10 or 20 times as many grammar schools, then that wouldn't happen. I think you would have more access to a, you know, high level of education for more working class kids.
Just as you talk about grammar schools, we've got a comment from Jed Into Orbit, who says that the grammar school system was good at getting bright working classes into the top of universities. But of course, it threatens the elite, so they shut them down. Ben, same question, if you like, about, you know, the one that I've just put to Chris in those terms. What do you think?
I think there's two things. I mean, government can certainly help some of it. If you want to really, because you talk about, you know, improving education attainment all the time, and the figures are great. You know, more kids getting basic English and maths, and more kids doing better at phonics, and all the rest of it is fantastic. It's what you do with those who are left, who therefore are falling far behind. And a lot of that comes back to public services, ultimately, in my view. It's, you know, what interventions can you make to support those kids who maybe are in care, or maybe are at failing schools, or what can you do? I think that means, you know, I've written about it before, you know, flying squads into some of these real failing schools and bringing in real, you know, high quality teachers and staff and academies perhaps into some of those schools. It's really difficult to attract good teachers to come and work in really difficult areas. So there is that battle. How do you get better teachers into those failing schools to work with these kids? But there is a market solution as well, I think. And it is, you know, what Chris touched on. It's academies and preschools, but we've kind of half done it in that we've said, you know, have the freedom to go and do what you like, but actually you've got to sit all the same qualifications and you've got all the same monitoring requirements as everybody else. So it's not really that free. If you were to say, look, you know, set up a school that meets the needs of your community and hopefully it works, and we'll obviously make sure it's doing everything it needs to do, but be free and go and do that rather than being so prescriptive in what it needs to deliver, I think you could fill some of these gaps. I'd love to see, and we've applied for in Mansfield, you know, a real kind of pathway into NHS services, a digital NHS school with the NHS Trust sitting on the governance of the school and using all of their kit and equipment. Could be an amazing thing, but you know, government's always very keen on broad knowledge-based curriculum, grammar school style education type of thing. I think for me, education is horses for courses, right, rather than a one-size-fits-all thing. So I'd like to see more choice.
Ben, you clearly speak passionately about this and you've been an outspoken campaigner in this area. But how much awareness of this issue do you think that there is amongst your fellow politicians in general, across the political spectrum? You know, is it an issue that people are aware of but don't consider a priority? Or is it not really recognised as a problem when you talk to your fellow MPs and parliamentarians in Westminster?
I think it hasn't been, but that's changing. The 2019 election brought in a very different cohort of Conservative MPs compared to the past. And we've got a lot more, you know, young working class lads, actually, in this place from some of the seats where these challenges are the most difficult. So there's definitely a different viewpoint. There's been, you know, myself and a Labour MP called Alex Norris from Nottingham in the previous parliament who spoke about this quite a bit. But I hope that there will be a lot of voices. We've got a group, as you'll know, called Blue Collar Conservatives, which brings a lot of these kind of new MPs in particular from some of our more Red War working class kind of constituencies. And there's a real drive behind some of this stuff. As I say, I think the shift to things like further education rather than university or you know, some of the investment in schools, even the, I moan a lot about the drive for kind of knowledge rich education and standards all the time, but that has been really beneficial to a lot of kids. I hope what we can do with this new cohort who perhaps sees things slightly differently is, as I said before, focus on that bottom group who hasn't benefited from the increase in attainment so far.
Well, to round up, let's go back to the questions on YouTube. We've got a couple more questions in. I'm going to put them both to you, starting with you, Chris, and then to you, Ben. Stuart Barr asks, is one of the problems that the word diversity itself has been politically hijacked from its origins of creating structures that are greater than the sum of the parts? Hold that thought for a minute on diversity. And Jez Giant Chicken asks the question, the Michaela School is admirable, but I wonder how widely that approach could be effective against a long ingrained culture of anti-intellectualism and low expectations throughout the country. So what are your views on those two questions, Chris?
I'll take the second one first. I mean, I don't think a long history of low expectations means that much to an 11-year-old. You know, I think you can mould that person. So I don't think that the generations of culture permeate so much into a child. I think, as Michaela School has shown, you can really make big changes by creating a more positive environment in the school itself. The first question is quite a good question. I'm not quite sure how to answer it about diversity. I mean, I just think that there is a certain amount of superficiality about some of the diversity you see in corporations and in the BBC. Not just in the lack of diversity of thought, but once you get beyond the skin color of certain people or the sexuality of certain people or the gender, you're often dealing with essentially metropolitan people, you know, internationalist people who've gone to international schools, gone to private schools, whose parents are often pretty rich. It's a very superficial diversity that is not actually doing anything really to chip away at privilege or disadvantage.
Ben, how about you? Questions on diversity and also anti-intellectualism.
I think diversity definitely has shifted. I think the Equalities Act has a lot to answer for from that perspective. It's so often misinterpreted as being almost a legal drive for positive discrimination rather than what it's meant to be, which is, you know, making sure that things are actually equal. But even government departments are guilty of doing that. So there's a real, almost a restatement of those values and what it really means that needs to happen, I think, in my view, for some of these public institutions. In terms of the anti-intellectualism, I mean, so Michaela is an amazing example of what can be done. And various replicas of it will spring up around the country, I'm sure, and do really, really well. My caveat, I suppose, is as I said before, I don't think one size fits all in education. I don't think you can just say, as Catherine Birbal Singh from Michaela is fantastic. I don't think you can just turn around and say a school with the same values and ethos and academic focus will work everywhere. I mean, you're not going to get a Catherine Birbal Singh everywhere in terms of teaching staff and what's available. You're not going to get the same high quality everywhere. But I also think that there are plenty of kids in communities like mine who actually, you know, they don't drive towards that. They don't aspire to get great A-levels and go to university. As I said before, are guilty of pressing our own aspirations onto kids sometimes. If what they want to do and what they aspire to do is to go and work in my dad's garage, well, for God's sake, let's help them to be great mechanics then. I don't really see the need to direct people if they have their own thoughts and views on what they want to achieve. I'd like to see exemplar kind of brilliant schools like Michaela, but across the whole range of different kinds of education that pop up all over the country.
All right, look, I've just almost sort of final whistle, had another comment come through. So we're in extra time here, or a time added on. It's Winsome Haxis asks, the teaching profession is dominated by far left women committed to ensuring that future generations will not see white males in charge. Working class boys have no one to defend them against this. What's your initial reaction to that, Chris?
Well, I'll leave that as a statement, I think, rather than a question.
Okay. And Ben, do you want to smile or leave it as a statement?
Yeah, I know some far left teachers. I know some Tory ones as well. I think teachers have an incredibly difficult job, especially in very challenging areas with real social problems. And in a lot of cases, you know, my primary school teachers in particular are more often than not social workers before they are teachers. I think that's the battle. If we have more choice, more freedom in schools, you can set up different kinds of schools that maybe push for different mindsets as well. But, you know, I wouldn't knock what teachers do for anything.
Well, let me ask you a variation on this. You know, you're a Conservative politician. Is there an opportunity for the Conservatives here? It was interesting that you said that both yourself and a Labour politician had raised this issue, which gives hope for those who want to see this done across the political spectrum. But if you think about a conversation I had with a former member of the Romford Labour Party, who told me he'd left the Labour Party to join the Conservatives because he said to me that the Labour Party no longer cared about the white working class, particularly after the referendum. And also Paul Mason, the well-known left-wing commentator, who said that the left-wing movements had to find a new working class because they couldn't rely on this working class because they all voted Tory in December. Does that then offer an opportunity for you as a Conservative politician? And or is there a danger that by mainstream parties ignoring these white working class, you saw what happened not very long ago in this country, where they tended to drift and vote for the BNP, the extremist parties? How do you see that in terms of the political impact, Ben?
I mentioned Alex Norris, who's the Nottingham MP, who's been really positive on this stuff, constituency neighbour, so we talk about it a great deal. But I've also been accused of, you know, all sorts of racism and needing to check my white privilege by Labour MPs when I bring this stuff up in the House. So there is a real mix, and I think they're newer MPs, are probably more radical than some of the old guard. Which does present an opportunity, right? We saw it in 2019. We saw these decade-long Labour seats that turned blue because, you know, people don't buy into the kind of Corbynista approach to things. What I think happens and will continue to happen if we focus right is that people actually broadly might be fairly centre-leftish economically, I think. They're happy for us to invest and spend quite a bit of money. But culturally and socially have really strong small-c conservative values across huge working-class parts of the country, bought into what we were saying, tough on law and order, tough on immigration, and all sorts of messages from that election that were really positive that Labour just do not speak to. And so if we carry on, you know, pushing down those lines and the levelling up agenda, I think is the right thing, then we can win more of those seats. I don't think it's a high watermark at all. just needs Labour to sort their act out, maybe, and maybe they'll make a bit of a comeback. But it's certainly an opportunity.
And taking a step away from the political picture, Ben, if I ask you in rounding up, you know, at the end of this programme, what do you want to see happen to tackle some of the disadvantages that we've been talking about throughout this programme? How would you sum it up?
I think it's a lifelong thing, right? We need to look at from the very earliest years, because all the data suggests that, you know, by the time you're 3, 4, 5, if you're mega behind in terms of education and entertainment, you will remain so. And it's those earliest years where I think, you know, I'm pretty free market, kind of get on, do what you like kind of politician. But I think education is the one area where if you're going to expect people as adults to be able to be capable and responsible of looking after themselves and not needing the government to bail them out, you need to make sure we've got the right things in place, the right interventions in place to give everybody the opportunity to do that. So I want to see us really get involved in early years education. I want to see us have more diversity across our school system, diversity in terms of kinds of education and what opportunities are available to people. I want to see us put the kind of emphasis that we put in, that was put into the London Challenge, into disadvantaged parts of the whole country. And I think you could do a great deal by doing that. You can't fix everything. You can't make people, you know, work hard or whatever it may be, but you can certainly put the stepping stones in place that mean there are more opportunities for these lads to take.
Well, thank you very much. And Chris, a final word from you. You wrote the article. As you've written the article and you've reflected on some of the things you wrote in the article, you know, what are your hopes for the future?
School vouchers, I think. Probably the answer. It's a good, solid IEA answer. But the system of school vouchers, get the government out of education so much as possible, give people choice, let a thousand flowers bloom. And I think we'll get the kind of thing that Ben quite rightly says he wants, which is not this one-size-fits-all, everybody has to be a lawyer mentality.
It's quite a contrast, because a lot of people would often answer, there is no silver bullet. You do think there's a silver bullet in educational vouchers. So Ben Bradley, MP, Chris Snowden, Head of Lifestyle Economics at the IEA, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Can I thank the viewers for joining us? Please don't forget to hit the subscribe button for IEA London. For more details of all our online content and to stay updated on our activity, please visit our website, iea.org.uk. Check out our YouTube channel, IEA London, the one that you're watching at the moment. Listen to our podcast on Podbean or subscribe to our daily newsletter. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at iea.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening again today. We hope that you'll join us again. Stay safe, and we'll see you again soon. Thank you.